well. These accidents don't have to be external, like falling from a ladder or being attacked by a bear. They can also be internal, from random malfunctioning of your organs or circulation. On the other hand, animals that don't really age, say turtles and crocodiles, seem to have a remaining life expectancy that stays constant for a long time. If a 20-year-old crocodile has 40 more years to live, owing to the perils of the habitat, a 40-year-old one will also have about 40 years to live. Let us use as shorthand Lindy-proof, is Lindy, or Lindy-compatible, one can substitute for another, to show something that seems to belong to the class of things that have proven to have the following property. That which is Lindy is what ages in reverse, i.e., its life expectancy lengthens with time, conditional on survival. Only the non-perishable can be Lindy. When it comes to ideas, books, technologies, procedures, institutions, and political systems under Lindy, there is no intrinsic aging and perishability. A physical copy of War and Peace can age, particularly when the publisher cuts corners to save 20 cents on paper for a $50 book. The book itself as an idea doesn't. Note that thanks to Lindy, no expert is the final expert anymore, and we do not need meta-experts judging the expertise of experts one rank below them. We solve the turtles all the way down problem. The turtles all the way down expression expresses an infinite regress problem as follows. The logician Bertrand Russell was once told that the world sits on turtles. And what do these turtles stand on? He asked. It's turtles all the way down, was the answer. Fragility is the expert, hence time and survival. The Lindy of Lindy. The idea of the Lindy effect is itself Lindy-proof. The pre-Socratic thinker Periander of Corinth wrote, more than 2,500 years ago, "Use laws that are old, but food that is fresh." Likewise, Alfonso X of Spain, nicknamed El Sabio, the wise, had as a maxim, "Burn old logs, drink old wine, read old books, keep old friends." The insightful and luckily non-academic historian Tom Holland once commented, "The thing I most admire about the Romans was the utter contempt they were capable of showing the cult of youth." He also wrote, "The Romans judged their political system by asking not whether it made sense, but whether it worked." Which is why, while dedicating this book, I called Ron Paul a Roman among Greeks. Do we need a judge? As I mentioned earlier in Prologue 3, I have held for most of my, sort of, academic career no more than a quarter position. A quarter is enough to have somewhere to go, particularly when it rains in New York, without being emotionally socialized and losing intellectual independence for fear of missing a party or having to eat alone. But one, now resigned, department head one day came to me and emitted the warning, "Just as, when a businessman and author you are judged by other businessmen and authors, here, as an academic, you are judged by other academics. Life is about peer assessment." It took me a while to overcome my disgust. I am still not fully familiar with the way non-risk-takers work. They actually don't realize that others are not like them and can't get what makes real people tick. No, businessmen as risk-takers are not subjected to the judgment of other businessmen, only to that of their personal accountant. They just need to avoid having a documented record of some ethical violations. Furthermore, not only did you not want peer approval, you wanted disapproval, except for ethical matters. An old fellow pit trader once shared his wisdom. If people over here like you, you are doing something wrong. Further, you can define a free person precisely as someone whose fate is not centrally or directly dependent on peer assessment. And as an essayist, I am not judged by other writers, book editors, and book reviewers, but by readers. Readers? Maybe, but wait a minute. Not today's readers, only those of tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. So, my only real judge being time, it is the stability and robustness of the readership, that is, future readers, that counts. The fashion-oriented, steady reader of the most recently reviewed book in the New York Times is of no interest to me. And as a risk-taker, only time counts. For I could fool my accountant with steady earnings with a lot of hidden risk, but time will eventually reveal them. Being reviewed or assessed by others matters if and only if one is subjected to the judgment of future, not just present, others. And recall that a free person does not need to win arguments, just win. An observation about modernity. Change for the sake of change, as we see in architecture, food, and lifestyle, is frequently the opposite of progress. As I have explained in Antifragile, too high a rate of mutation prevents locking in the benefits of previous changes. Evolution and progress require some, but not too frequent, variation. Tea with the Queen. Peers devolve honors, memberships in academies, Nobels, invitations to Davos and similar venues, tea and cucumber sandwiches with the Queen, requests by rich name-droppers to attend cocktail parties where you see only people who are famous. Believe me, there are rich people whose lives revolve around these things. They usually claim to be trying to save the world, the bears, the children, the mountains, the deserts, all the ingredients of the broadcasting of virtue. But clearly they can't influence Lindy. In fact, it is the reverse. If you spend your time trying to impress others in the New York Club 21, there may be something wrong with you. Contemporary peers are valuable collaborators, not final judges. Prizes is a curse. In fact, there is a long-held belief among traders that praise by journalists is a reverse indicator. I learned about it the hard way. In 1983, right before I became a trader, the computer giant IBM made the front cover of Business Week, a U.S. magazine then influential, as the ultimate company. I naively rushed to buy the stock. I got shellacked. Then it hit me that, if anything, I should be shorting the company to benefit from its decline. So I reversed the trade and learned that collective praise by journos is at the least suspicious and at best a curse. IBM went into a decline that lasted a decade and a half. It almost went bust. Further, I learned to avoid honors and prizes partly because, given that they are awarded by the wrong judges, they are likely to hit you at the peak. You'd rather be ignored, or better, disliked by the general media. A former trader who invests in the restaurant business, Brian Hinchcliffe, conveyed to me the following heuristic. Shops that get awards as the best something, best atmosphere, best waiter service, best fermented yogurt and other non-alcoholic beverages for visiting shakes, etc., close down before the award ceremony. Empirically, if you want an author to cross a few generations, make sure he or she never gets that something called the Nobel Prize in Literature. Institutions. In fact, there is something worse than peer assessment. The bureaucratization of the activity creates a class of new judges, university administrators, who have no clue what someone is doing except via external signals, yet become the actual arbiters. These arbiters fail to realize that prestigious publication, determined by peer reviewers in a circular manner, are not Lindy compatible. They only mean that a certain set of currently powerful people are happy with your work. Hard science might be robust to the pathologies, even then. So let us take a look at social science. Given that the sole judges of a contributor are his peers, there is a citation ring in place that can lead to all manner of rotting. Macroeconomics, for instance, can be nonsense since it is easier to macro BS than micro BS. Nobody can tell if a theory really works. If you say something crazy, you will be deemed crazy. But if you create a collection of, say, 20 people who set up an academy and say crazy things accepted by the collective, you now have peer reviewing and can start a department in a university. Academia has a tendency, when unchecked, from lack of skin in the game, to evolve into a ritualistic, self-referential publishing game. Now, while academia has turned into an athletic contest, Wittgenstein held the exact opposite viewpoint. If anything, knowledge is the reverse of an athletic contest. In philosophy, the winner is the one who finishes last, he said. Further, anything that smacks of competition destroys knowledge. In some areas, such as gender studies or psychology, the ritualistic publishing game gradually maps less and less to real research, by the very nature of the agency problem, to reach a mafia-like divergence of interest. Researchers have their own agenda, at variance with what their clients, that is, society and the students, are paying them for. The opacity of the subject to outsiders helps them control the gates. Knowing economics doesn't mean knowing anything about economics in the sense of the real activity, but rather the theories, most of which are BS, produced by economists. And courses in universities, for which hard-working parents need to save over decades, easily degenerate into fashion. You work hard and save for your children to be taught a post-colonial study-oriented critique of quantum mechanics. But there is a ray of hope. Actually, recent events indicate how the system will fold. Alumni, who happen to have worked in the real world, are starting to cut funds to spurious and farcical disciplines, though not to the farcical approaches within traditional disciplines. After all, it so happens that someone needs to pay the salaries of macroeconomists and post-colonial gender experts, and university education needs to compete with professional training workshops. Once upon a time, studying post-colonial theories could help one get a job other than serving French fries. No longer. Against one's interest. The most convincing statements are those in which one stands to lose, ones in which one has maximal skin in the game. The most unconvincing ones are those in which one patently but unknowingly tries to enhance one's status without making a tangible contribution, like, as we saw, in the great majority of academic papers that say nothing and take no risks. But it doesn't have to be that way. Showing off is reasonable. It is human. As long as the substance exceeds the show-off, you are fine. Stay human. Take as much as you can, under the condition that you give more than you take. One should give more weight to research that, while being rigorous, contradicts other peers, particularly if it entails costs and reputational harm for its author. Further, someone with a high public presence who is controversial and takes risks for his opinion is less likely to be a BS vendor. I am usually allergic to some public personalities, but not others. It took me a while to figure out how to draw the line explicitly. The difference is risk-taking and whether the person worries about his or her reputation. Soul in the game again. The deprostitutionalization of research will eventually be done as follows. Force people who want to do research to do it on their own time, that is, to derive their income from other sources. Sacrifice is necessary. It may seem absurd to brainwashed contemporaries, but Antifragile documents the outsized historical contributions of the non-professional, or, rather, the non-meretricious. For their research to be genuine, they should first have a real-world day job, or at least spend 10 years as lensmaker, patent clerk, mafia operator, professional gambler, postman, prison guard, medical doctor, limo driver, militia member, social security agent, trial lawyer, farmer, restaurant chef, high-volume waiter, firefighter, my favorite, lighthouse keeper, etc., while they are building their original ideas. It is a filtering, nonsense-expurgating mechanism. I have no sympathy for moaning professional researchers. I, for my part, spent 23 years in a full-time, highly demanding, extremely stressful profession while studying, researching, and writing my first 3 books at night. It lowered, in fact eliminated, my tolerance for career-building research. There is this illusion that just as businessmen are motivated and rewarded by profits, scientists should be motivated and rewarded by honors and recognition. That's not how it works. Remember, science is a minority rule. A few will run it. Others are just back-office clerks. Science is Lindy-prone. We said earlier that without skin in the game, survival mechanisms are severely disrupted. This also applies to ideas. Karl Popper's idea of science is an enterprise that produces claims that can be contradicted by eventual observations, not a series of verifiable ones. Science is fundamentally disconfirmatory, not confirmatory. This mechanism of falsification is entirely Lindy-compatible. It actually requires the operation of the Lindy effect in combination with the minority rule. Although Popper saw the statics, he didn't study the dynamics, nor did he look at the risk dimension of things. The reason science works isn't because there is a proper scientific method derived by some nerds in isolation, or some standard that passes a test similar to the eye exam of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Rather, it is because scientific ideas are Lindy-prone, that is, subjected to their own natural fragility. Ideas need to have skin in the game. You know an idea will fail if it is not useful, and can be therefore vulnerable to the falsification of time, and not that of naive falsificationism, that is, according to some government-printed black-and-white guideline. The longer an idea has been around without being falsified, the longer its future life expectancy. For if you read Paul Feyerabend's account of the history of scientific discoveries, you can clearly see that anything goes in the process, but not with the test of time. That appears to be non-negotiable. Note that I am here modifying Popper's idea. We can replace true, rather not false, with useful, even not harmful, even protective to its users. So I will diverge from Popper in the following. For things to survive, they necessarily need to fare well in the risk dimension, that is, be good at not dying. By the Lindy effect, if an idea has skin in the game, it is not in the truth game, but in the harm game. An idea survives if it is a good risk manager, that is, not only doesn't harm its holders, but favors their survival. This also applies to superstitions that have crossed centuries because they led to some protective actions. More technically, an idea needs to be convex, anti-fragile, or at least bring about a beneficial reduction of fragility somewhere. Empirical or theoretic? Academics divide research into theoretical and empirical areas. Empiricism consists in looking at data on a computer in search for what they call statistically significant, or doing experiments in the laboratory under some purposefully narrow conditions. Doing things in the real world, in some professions, such as medicine, bears the name clinical, which is not deemed to be scientific. Many disciplines lack this third dimension, the clinical one. For in fact, by the Lindy effect, robustness to time, that is, doing things under risk-taking conditions, is checked by survival. Things work, one, if those who have been doing the doing took some type of risk, and two, their work manages to cross generations. Which brings me to the grandmother. The grandmother versus the researchers. If you hear advice from a grandmother or elders, odds are that it works 90% of the time. On the other hand, in part because of scientism and academic prostitution, in part because the world is hard, if you read anything by psychologists and behavioral scientists, odds are that it works at less than 10%, unless it has also been covered by the grandmother and the classics, in which case why would you need a psychologist? In a technical note called Meta-Distribution of P-Values around the stochasticity of P-Values and their hacking by researchers, I show that the statistical significance of these papers is at least one order of magnitude smaller than claimed. Consider that a recent effort to replicate the 100 psychology papers in prestigious journals of 2008 found that, out of 100, only 39 replicated. Of these 39, I believe that fewer than 10 are actually robust and transfer outside the narrowness of the experiment. Similar defects have been found in medicine and neuroscience. More on those later. I will discuss the point further in chapters 18 and mostly 19, as well as why the warnings of your grandmother or interdicts aren't irrational. Most of what is called irrational comes from misunderstanding of probability. It is critical that it is not just that the books of the ancients are still around and have been filtered by Lindy, but that those populations who read them have survived as well. While our knowledge of physics was not available to the ancients, human nature was. So everything that holds in social science and psychology has to be Lindy-proof, that is, have an antecedent in the classics. Otherwise, it will not replicate or not generalize beyond the experiment. By classics, we can define the Latin and late Hellenistic moral literature. Moral sciences meant something else than they do today. Cicero, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, Lucian, or the poets, Juvenal, Horace, or the later French so-called moralists, La Rochefoucauld, Fauvenargues, La Bruyère Chamfort. Bossuet is a class on his own. One can use Montaigne and Erasmus as a portal to the ancients. Montaigne was the popularizer of his day. Erasmus was the thorough compiler. A brief tour of your grandparents' wisdom. Let us now close by sampling a few ideas that exist in both ancient lore and are sort of reconfirmed by modern psychology. These are sampled organically, meaning they are not the result of research, but of what spontaneously comes to mind. Remember, this book is called Skin in the Game, then verified in the texts. Cognitive dissonance, a psychological theory by Leon Festinger about sour grapes, by which people, in order to avoid inconsistent beliefs, rationalize that, say, the grapes they can't reach got to be sour. It is seen first in Aesop, of course, repackaged by La Fontaine. But its roots look even more ancient, with the Assyrian Ahikar of Nineveh. Loss aversion, a psychological theory by which a loss is more painful than a gain is pleasant. In Livy's Annals, Book 30, Chapter 21, men feel the good less intensely than the bad. Nearly all the letters of Seneca have some element of loss aversion. Negative advice, via negativa. We know the wrong better than what's right. Recall the superiority of the silver over the golden rule. The good is not as good as the absence of bad. Ennius, repeated by Cicero. Skin in the game, literally. We start with a Yiddish proverb, you can't chew with somebody else's teeth. Your fingernail can best scratch your itch. Picked up by Scaliger, circa 1614, in Proverborum Arabicorum. Anti-fragility. There are tens of ancient sayings. Let us just mention Cicero. When our souls are mollified, a bee can sting. See also Machiavelli and Rousseau for its application to political systems. Time discounting. A bird in the hand is better than 10 on the tree. Levantine proverb. Madness of crowds. Nietzsche. Madness is rare in individuals, but in groups, parties, nations, it is the rule. This counts as ancient wisdom since Nietzsche was a classicist. I've seen many such references in Plato. Less is more. Truth is lost with too much altercation. In Publilius Syrus. But of course the expression less is more is in an 1855 poem by Robert Browning. Overconfidence. I lost money because of my excessive confidence. Erasmus, inspired by Theognis of Megara. Confident I lost everything, defiant I saved everything. An Epicharmus of Cos. Remain sober and remember to watch out. The paradox of progress and the paradox of choice. There is a familiar story of a New York banker vacationing in Greece who, from talking to a fisherman and scrutinizing the fisherman's business, comes up with a scheme to help the fisherman make it a big business. The fisherman asked him what the benefits were. The banker answered that he could make a pile of money in New York and come back to vacation in Greece, something that seemed ludicrous to the fisherman, who was already there doing the kind of things bankers do when they go on vacation in Greece. The story was well known in antiquity under a more elegant form, as retold by Montaigne, my translation. When King Pyrrhus tried to cross into Italy, Cineas, his wise advisor, tried to make him feel the vanity of such action. To what end are you going into such enterprise? He asked. Pyrrhus answered, to make myself the master of Italy, Cineas. And so, Pyrrhus, to get to Gaul, then Spain. Cineas, then, Pyrrhus, to conquer Africa, then, come rest at ease. Cineas, but you are already there. Why take more risks? Montaigne then cites the well-known passage in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura, Book 5, line 1431, on how human nature knows no upper bound, as if to punish itself. Book 6. Deeper into Agency. Chapter 9. Surgeons should not look like surgeons. Literature doesn't look like literature. Donaldo hiring practitioners. The glory of bureaucracy. Teach a professor how to deadlift. Looking the part. Looking the part. Say you had the choice between two surgeons of similar rank in the same department in some hospital. The first is highly refined in appearance. He wears silver-rimmed glasses, has a thin build, delicate hands, measured speech, and elegant gestures. His hair is silver and well-combed. He is the person you would put in a movie if you needed to impersonate a surgeon. His office prominently boasts Ivy League diplomas, both for his undergraduate and medical schools. The second one looks like a butcher. He is overweight, with large hands, uncouth speech, and an unkempt appearance. His shirt is dangling from the back. No known tailor on the east coast of the U.S. is capable of making his shirt button at the neck. He speaks unapologetically with a strong New York accent, as if he wasn't aware of it. He even has a gold tooth showing when he opens his mouth. The absence of diplomas on the wall hints at the lack of pride in his education. He perhaps went to some local college. In a movie, you would expect him to impersonate a retired bodyguard for a junior congressman or a third-generation cook in a New Jersey cafeteria. Now, if I had to pick, I would overcome my sucker proneness and take the butcher any minute. Even more, I would seek the butcher as a third option if my choice was between two doctors who looked like doctors. Why? Simply, the one who doesn't look the part, conditional on having made a sort of successful career in his profession, had to have much to overcome in terms of perception. And if we are lucky enough to have people who do not look the part, it is thanks to the presence of some skin in the game, the contact with reality that filters out incompetence, as reality is blind to looks. When results come from dealing directly with reality rather than through the agency of commentators, image matters less, even if it correlates to skills. But image matters quite a bit when there is hierarchy and standardized job evaluation. Consider the chief executive officers of corporations. They don't just look the part, they even look the same. And worse, when you listen to them talk, they sound the same, down to the same vocabulary and metaphors. But that's their job. As I will keep reminding the reader, counter to the common belief, executives are different from entrepreneurs and are supposed to look like actors. Now, there may be some correlation between looks and skills. Someone who looks athletic is likely to be athletic. But, conditional on having had some success in spite of not looking the part, it is potent, even crucial, information. So it becomes no wonder that the job of chief executive of the country was once filled by a former actor, Ronald Reagan. Actually, the best actor is the one nobody realizes is an actor. A closer look at Barack Obama shows that he was even more of an actor. A fancy Ivy League education combined with a liberal reputation is compelling as an image builder. Much has been written about the millionaire next door, the person who is actually rich on balance, but doesn't look like the person you would expect to be rich, and vice versa. About every private banker is taught to not be fooled by the looks of the client and avoid chasing Ferrari owners at country clubs. As I am writing these lines, a neighbor in my ancestral village, and like almost everyone there, a remote relative, who led a modest but comfortable life, ate food he grew by himself, drank his own pastis, Eric, that sort of thing, left an estate of $100 million, 100 times what one would have expected him to leave. So the next time you randomly pick a novel, avoid the one with the author photo representing a pensive man with an ascot standing in front of wall-to-wall bookshelves. By the same reasoning, and flipping the arguments, skilled thieves at large should not look like thieves. Those who do are more likely to be in jail. Next, we will get deeper into the following. In any type of activity or business divorced from the direct filter of skin in the game, the great majority of people know the jargon, play the part, and are intimate with the cosmetic details, but are clueless about the subject. The green lumber fallacy. The idea of this chapter is Lindy compatible. Don't think that beautiful apples taste better, goes the Latin saying. This is a subtler version of the common phrase, all that glitters is not gold, something it has taken consumers half a century to figure out, even then, as they have been continuously fooled by the aesthetics of produce. An expert rule in my business is to never hire a well-dressed trader, but it goes beyond. Hire the successful trader conditional on a solid track record, whose details you can understand the least. Not the most, the least. Why so? I've introduced this point in Anti-Fragile, where I called it the green lumber fallacy. A fellow made a fortune in green lumber without knowing what appears to be essential details about the product he traded. He wasn't aware that green lumber stood for freshly cut wood, not lumber that was painted green. Meanwhile, by contrast, the person who related the story went bankrupt while knowing every intimate detail about the green lumber. The fallacy is that what one may need to know in the real world does not necessarily match what one can perceive through intellect. It doesn't mean that details are not relevant, only that those we tend, IYI style, to believe are important can distract us from more central attributes of the price mechanism. In any activity, hidden details are only revealed via Lindy. Another aspect. What can be phrased and expressed in a clear narrative that convinces suckers will be a sucker trap. My friend Terry B., who taught an investment class, invited two speakers. One looked the part of the investment manager, down to a T, tailored clothes, expensive watch, shiny shoes, and clarity of exposition. He also talked big, projecting the type of confidence you would desire in an executive. The second looked closer to our butcher-surgeon and was totally incomprehensible. He even gave the impression that he was confused. Now, when Terry asked the students which of the two they believed was more successful, they didn't even get close. The first, not unexpectedly, was in the equivalent of the soup kitchen of that business. The second was at least a centimillionaire. The late Jimmy Powers, a die-hard New York Irishman with whom I worked in an investment bank early in my trading career, was successful in spite of being a college dropout, with the background of a minor Brooklyn street gangster. He would discuss our trading activities in meetings with such sentences as, "We did this and then did that, bada-boom, bada-bing, and then it was all groovy," to an audience of extremely befuddled executives who didn't mind not understanding what he was talking about, so long as our department was profitable. Remarkably, after a while, I learned to effortlessly understand what Jimmy meant. I also learned in my early 20s that the people you understand most easily were necessarily the BSers. Best-dressed business plan. Literature should not look like literature. The author Georges Simenon worked as a teenager in journalism as an assistant to the famous French writer Colette. She taught him to resist the idea of putting imperfect subjunctives and references to zephyrs, rhododendrons, and firmaments in his text, the kind of stuff one does when waxing literary. Simenon took this advice to the extreme. His style is similar to that of, say, Graham Greene. It is stripped to the core, and as a result, words do not stand in the way of conveying atmosphere. You feel wetness penetrating your shoes just reading his accounts of Commissar Maigret spending endless hours in the Parisian rain. It is as if his central character is the background. Likewise, the illusion prevails that businesses work via business plans and science via funding. This is strictly not true. A business plan is a useful narrative for those who want to convince a sucker. It works because, as I said in Prologue 2, firms in the entrepreneurship business make most of their money packaging companies and selling them. It is not easy to sell without some strong narrative. But for a real business, as opposed to a fundraising scheme, something that should survive on its own, business plans and funding work backward. At the time of writing, most big recent successes, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google, were started by people with skin and soul in the game and grew organically. If they had recourse to funding, it was to expand or allow the managers to cash out. Funding was not the prime source of creation. You don't create a firm by creating a firm, nor do you do science by doing science. A bishop for Halloween. Which brings me back to social science. I have, in many instances, quickly jotted down ideas on a piece of paper, along with mathematical proofs, and posted them somewhere, planning to get them published. No fluff or the ideas-free, verbose circularity of social science papers. In some fake fields like economics, ritualistic and dominated by citation rings, I discovered that everything is in the presentation. So the criticism I've received has never been about the content, but rather the looks. There is a certain language one needs to learn through a long investment, and papers are just iterations around that language. Never hire an academic unless his function is to partake of the rituals of writing papers or taking exams. Which brings us to the attributes of scientism. For it is not just some presentation that matters to these idiots. It is unnecessary complication. But there is a logic behind these academic complications and rituals. Did you ever wonder why a bishop is dressed for Halloween? Mediterranean societies are traditionally ones in which the highest-ranking person is the one with the most skin in the game. And if anything characterizes today's America, it is economic risk-taking, thanks to a happy transfer of martial values to business and commerce in Anglo-Saxon society. Remarkably, traditional Arabic culture also puts the same emphasis on the honor of economic risk-taking. But history shows that there were, and still are, societies in which the intellectual was at the top. The Hindus held the Brahmin to be first in the hierarchy. The Celts had the Druids. So did their Druze possible cousins. The Egyptians had their scribes, and the Chinese had, for a relatively brief time, the scholar. Let me add post-war France. You can notice a remarkable similarity to the way these intellectuals held power and separated themselves from the rest, through complex, extremely elaborate rituals, mysteries that stay within the caste, and an overriding focus on the cosmetic. Even within the normal warrior-run or doer-run societies, the class of intellectuals is all about rituals. Without pomp and ceremony, the intellectual is just a talker, that is, pretty much nothing. Consider the bishop in my parts, the Greek Orthodox Church. It's a show of dignity. A bishop on rollerblades would no longer be a bishop. There is nothing wrong with a decorative if it remains what it is, decorative, as remains true today. However, science and business must not be decorative. Next, we examine the following points. Just as the slick fellow in a Ferrari looks richer than the rumpled centimillionaire, scientism looks more scientific than real science. True intellect should not appear to be intellectual. The Gordian Knot. Never pay for complexity of presentation when all you need is results. Alexander the Magnus was once called to solve the following challenge in the Phrygian city of Gordium, as usual with Greek stories in modern-day Turkey. When he entered Gordium, he found an old wagon, its yoke tied with a multitude of knots, all so tightly entangled that it was impossible to figure out how they were fastened. An oracle had declared that he who would untie the knot would rule all of what was then called Asia, that is, Asia Minor, the Levant, and the Middle East. After wrestling with the knot, the Magnus drew back from the lump of gnarled ropes, then made a proclamation that it didn't matter for the prophecy how the tangle was to be unraveled. He then drew his sword and with a single stroke cut the knot in half. No successful academic could ever afford to follow such a policy, and no intellectual yet idiot. It took medicine a long time to realize that when a patient shows up with a headache, it is much better to give him aspirin or recommend a good night's sleep than do brain surgery, although the latter appears to be more scientific. But most consultants and others paid by the hour are not there yet. Over-intellectualization of life. The researchers Gerd Gigerenzer and Henry Brighton contrast the approaches of the rationalistic school, in quotation marks, as there is little that is rational in these rationalists, and that of the heuristic one, in the following example on how a baseball player catches the ball by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins argues that he behaves as if he had solved a set of differential equations in predicting the trajectory of the ball. At some subconscious level, something functionally equivalent to the mathematical calculations is going on. Instead, experiments have shown that players rely on several heuristics. The gaze heuristic is the simplest one and works if the ball is already high up in the air. Fix your gaze on the ball, start running, and adjust your running speed so that the angle of gaze remains constant. This error by the science writer Richard Dawkins generalizes to simply over-intellectualizing humans in their responses to all manner of natural phenomena, rather than accepting the role of a collection of mental heuristics used for specific purposes. The baseball player has no clue about the exact heuristic, but he goes with it. Otherwise, he would lose the game to another, non-intellectualizing competitor. Likewise, as we will see in Chapter 18, religious beliefs are simply mental heuristics that solve a collection of problems without the agent really knowing how. Solving equations in order to make a decision isn't a skill we humans can aspire to have. It is computationally impossible. What we can rationally do is neutralize some harmful aspects of these heuristics, defang them, so to speak. Another business of intervention. People who have always operated without skin in the game, or without their skin in the right game, seek the complicated and centralized, and avoid the simple like the plague. Practitioners, on the other hand, have opposite instincts, looking for the simplest heuristics, some rules. People who are bred, selected, and compensated to find complicated solutions do not have an incentive to implement simplified ones. And it gets more complicated as the remedy has itself a skin-in-the-game problem. This is particularly acute in the meta-problem, when the solution is about solving this very problem. In other words, many problems in society come from the interventions of people who sell complicated solutions because that's what their position and training invite them to do. There is absolutely no gain for someone in such a position to propose something simple. You are rewarded for perception, not results. Meanwhile, they pay no price for the side effects that grow non-linearly with such complications. This also holds true when it comes to solutions that are profitable to technologists. Gold and rice. Now, indeed, we know by instinct that brain surgery is not more scientific than aspirin, any more than flying the 40 or so miles between JFK and Newark airports represent efficiency, although there is more technology involved. But we don't easily translate this to other domains and remain victims of scientism, which is to science what a Ponzi scheme is to investment, or what advertisement or propaganda are to genuine scientific communication. You magnify the cosmetic attributes. Recall the genetic modifications of Book 3 and the smear campaign of Chapter 4. Let us consider the story of the genetically modified golden rice. There has been a problem of malnutrition and nutrient deficiency in many developing countries, which my collaborators Yanir Bar-Yam and Joe Norman attribute to a simple and very straightforward transportation issue. Simply, we waste more than a third of our food supply, and the gains from simple improvement in distribution would far outweigh those from modification of supply. Simply consider that close to 80 or 85% of the cost of a tomato can be attributed to transportation, storage, and waste, unsold inventories, rather than the cost at the farmer level. So visibly, our efforts should be on low-tech distribution. Now, the techies saw an angle of intervention. First, you show pictures of starving children to elicit sympathy and prevent further discussion. Anyone who argues in the presence of dying children is a heartless a-hole. Second, you make it look like any critic of your method is arguing against saving the children. Third, you propose some scientific-looking technique that is lucrative to you and, should it cause a catastrophe or blight, insulate you from the long-term effects. Fourth, you enlist journalists and useful idiots, people who hate things that appear unscientific in their unscientific eyes. Fifth, you create a smear campaign to harm the reputations of researchers who, not having FU money, are very vulnerable to the slightest blemish to their reputations. The technique in question consists in genetically modifying rice to have the grains include vitamins. My colleagues and I made an effort to show the following, which is a criticism of the method in general. First, transgenics, that is, the type of genetic modification thus obtained, was not analytically in the same category as the crossbreeding of plants and animals that have characterized human activities since husbandry, say, potatoes or mandarin oranges. We skipped complexity classes, and the effects on the environment are not foreseeable. Nobody studied the interactions. Recall that fragility is in the dosage. Falling from the 20th floor is not in the same risk category as falling from your chair. We even showed that there was a patent increase in systemic risk. Second, there was no proper risk study, and the statistical methods in the papers in support of the argument were flawed. Third, we invoked the principle of simplicity, which was called anti-science. Why don't we give these people rice and vitamins separately? After all, we don't have genetically modified coffee that has milk with it. Fourth, we were able to show that GMOs brought a bevy of hidden risk to the environment because of the higher use of pesticide, which kills the microbiome, that is, the bacteria and other life in the soil. I realized soon after that, owing to the minority rule, there was no point continuing. As I said in Book 3, GMOs lost simply because a minority of intelligent and intransigent people stood against them. The compensation. Simply, the minute one is judged by others rather than by reality, things become warped as follows. Firms that haven't gone bankrupt yet have something called personnel departments, so there are metrics used and evaluation forms to fill. The minute one has evaluation forms, distortions occur. Recall that in The Black Swan, I had to fill my evaluation form asking for the percentage of profitable days, encouraging traders to make steady money at the expense of hidden risks of black swans, consequential losses. Russian roulette allows you to make money 5 times out of 6. This has bankrupted banks, as banks lose less than 1 in 100 quarters, but then they lose more than they ever made. My declared approach was to try to make money infrequently. I tore the evaluation form in front of the big boss, and they left me alone. Now, the mere fact that an evaluation causes you to be judged not by the end results, but by some intermediary metric that invites you to look sophisticated, brings some distortions. Education is luxury good. Ivy League universities are becoming, in the eyes of the new Asian upper class, the ultimate status luxury good. Harvard is like a Vuitton bag and a Cartier watch. It is a huge drag on the middle class, who have been plowing an increased share of their savings into educational institutions, transferring their money to bureaucrats, real estate developers, tenured professors of some discipline that would not otherwise exist, gender studies, comparative literature, or international economics, and other parasites. In the United States, we have a buildup of student loans that automatically transfer to these rent extractors. In a way, it is no different from racketeering. One needs a decent university name to get ahead in life. But we have evidence that collectively, society doesn't advance with organized education. Rather, the reverse. The level of formal education in a country is the result of wealth. The same argument applies to biographies of scientists and mathematicians written by science journalists or professional biographers. They will find some narrative, and worse, put scientists on pedestals. A BS detection heuristic. The heuristic here would be to use education in reverse. Higher, conditional on an equal set of skills, the person with the least label-oriented education. It means that the person had to succeed in spite of the credentialization of his competitors and overcome more serious hurdles. In addition, people who didn't go to Harvard are easier to deal with in real life. You can tell if a discipline is BS if the degree depends severely on the prestige of the school granting it. I remember when I applied to MBA programs being told that anything outside the top 10 or 20 would be a waste of time. On the other hand, a degree in mathematics is much less dependent on the school, conditional on being above a certain level, so the heuristic would apply to the difference between top 10 and top 2,000 schools. The same applies to research papers. In math and physics, a result posted on the repository site archive with a minimum hurdle is fine. In low-quality fields like academic finance, where papers are usually some form of complicated storytelling, the prestige of the journal is the sole criterion. Real gyms don't look like gyms. This education labeling provides a lot of cosmetic things, but misses something essential about anti-fragility and true learning, reminiscent of gyms. People are impressed with expensive equipment, fancy, complicated, multicolored, meant to look as if it belonged on a spaceship. Things appear maximally sophisticated and scientific, but remember that what looks scientific is usually scientism, not science. As with label universities, you pay quite a bit of money to join, largely for the benefit of the real estate developer. Yet people into strength training, those who are actually strong across many facets of real life, know that users of these machines gain no strength beyond an initial phase. By having recourse to complicated equipment that typically targets very few muscles, regular users will eventually be pear-shaping and growing weaker over time, with skills that do not transfer outside of the very machine that they trained on. The equipment may have some use in a hospital or a rehabilitation program, but that's about it. On the other hand, the simpler barbell, a metal bar with two weights on both ends, is the only standard piece of equipment that gets you to recruit your entire body for exercises, and it is the simplest and cheapest to get. All you need to learn are the safety skills to move off the floor at your maximum while avoiding injury. Lindy again. Weightlifters have known the phenomenology for at least 2.5 millennia. All you need are shoes to run outside when you can, and perhaps some pants that don't make you look ridiculous, and a barbell with weights. As I'm writing these lines, I am checking the brochure of a fancy hotel where I will be spending the next 2 days. The brochure was put together by some MBA. It is glossy, shows all the machines and the jars of the color-rich juices to improve your health. They even have a swimming pool, but no barbell. And if gyms should not look like gyms, exercise should not look like exercise. Most gains in physical strength come from working the tails of the distribution, close to your limit. Next. This chapter managed to mix weightlifting and fundamental research under the single argument that, while the presence of skin in the game does away with the cosmetic, its absence causes multiplicative nonsense. Next, let us consider the divergence of interest between you and yourself when you become rich. Chapter 10. Only the rich are poisoned. The preferences of others. The salesman is the boss. How to drink poison. Advertising and manipulation. The unbearable silence of large mansions on Sunday evening. When people get rich, they shed their skin-in-the-game-driven experiential mechanism. They lose control of their preferences, substituting constructed preferences for their own, complicating their lives unnecessarily, triggering their own misery. And these constructed preferences are, of course, the preferences of those who want to sell them something. This is a skin-in-the-game problem, as the choices of the rich are dictated by others who have something to gain and no side effects from the sale. And given that they are rich and their exploiters not often so, nobody would shout victim. I once had dinner in a Michelin-starred restaurant with a fellow who insisted on eating there instead of my selection of a casual Greek taverna with a friendly owner-operator whose second cousin was the manager and third cousin once removed was the friendly receptionist. The other customers seemed, as we say in Mediterranean languages, to have a cork plugged in their behind, obstructing proper ventilation, causing the vapors to build on the inside of the gastrointestinal walls, leading to the irritable type of decorum you only notice in the educated semi-upper classes. I noted that, in addition to the plugged corks, all the men wore ties. Dinner consisted of a succession of complicated small things, with microscopic ingredients and contrasting tastes that forced you to concentrate as if you were taking some entrance exam. You were not eating, rather visiting some type of museum with an affected English major lecturing you on some artistic dimension you would have never considered on your own. There was so little that was familiar and so little that fit my taste buds. Once something on the occasion tasted like something real, there was no chance to have more as we moved on to the next dish. Trudging through the dishes and listening to some BS by the sommelier about the paired wine, I was afraid of losing concentration. It costs a lot of energy to fake that you're not bored. In fact, I discovered an optimization in the wrong place. The only thing I cared about, the bread, was not warm. It appears that this is not a Michelin requirement for 3 stars. Venenum in auro bibitur. I left the place starving. Now, if I had a choice, I would have had some time-tested recipe, say a pizza with very fresh ingredients or a juicy hamburger, in a lively place, for a 20th of the price. but because the dinner partner could afford the expensive restaurant, we ended up the victims of some complicated experiments by a chef judged by some Michelin bureaucrat. It would fail the Lindy effect. Food does better through minute variations from Sicilian grandmother to Sicilian grandmother. It hit me that the rich were natural targets. As the eponymous Thyestes shouts in Seneca's tragedy, thieves do not enter impecunious homes, and one is more likely to be drinking poison in a golden cup than an ordinary one. Poison is drunk in golden cups. Venenum in auro bibitur. It is easy to scam people by getting them into complications. The poor are spared that type of scamming. This is the same complication we saw in Chapter 9 that makes academics sell the most possibly complicated solution when a simple one can do. Further, the rich start using experts and consultants. An entire industry meant to swindle you will swindle you. Financial consultants, diet advisors, exercise experts, lifestyle engineers, sleeping counselors, breathing specialists, etc. Hamburgers, to many of us, are vastly tastier than filet mignon because of the higher fat content, but people have been convinced that the latter is better because it is more expensive to produce. My idea of the good life is to not attend a gala dinner, one of those situations where you find yourself stuck seated for 2 hours between the wife of a Kansas City real estate developer who just visited Nepal and a Washington lobbyist who just returned from a vacation in Bali. Large funeral homes. Same with real estate. Most people, I am convinced, are happier in close quarters, in a real barrio-style neighborhood, where they can feel human warmth and company. But when they have big bucks, they end up pressured to move into outsized, impersonal, and silent mansions, far away from neighbors. On late afternoons, the silence of these large galleries has a funereal feel to it, but without the soothing music. This is something historically rare. In the past, large mansions were teeming with servants, head servants, butlers, cooks, assistants, maids, private tutors, impoverished cousins, horse grooms, even personal musicians. And nobody today will come to console you for having a mansion. Few will realize that it is quite sad to be there on Sunday evening. As Vauvenargues, the French moralist, figured out, small is preferable owing to what we would call in today's terms scale properties. Some things can be, simply, too large for your heart. Rome, he wrote, was easy to love by its denizens when it was a small village, harder when it became a large empire. Prosperous people of the type who don't look rich are certainly aware of the point. They live in comfortable quarters and instinctively know that a move will be a mental burden. Many still live in their original houses. Very few people understand their own choices and end up being manipulated by those who want to sell them something. In that sense, impoverishment might even be desirable. Looking at Saudi Arabia, which should progressively revert to the pre-oil level of poverty, I wonder if taking away some things from them, including the swarm of fawning foreigners coming to skin them, will make them better off. To put it another way, if wealth is giving you fewer options instead of more and more varied options, you're doing it wrong. Conversation. If anything, being rich, you need to hide your money if you want to have what I call friends. This may be known. What is less obvious is that you may also need to hide your erudition and learning. People can only be social friends if they don't try to upstage or outsmart one another. Indeed, the classical art of conversation is to avoid any imbalance, as in Baldassare Castiglione's Book of the Courtier. People need to be equal, at least for the purpose of the conversation. Otherwise, it fails. It has to be hierarchy-free and equal in contribution. You'd rather have dinner with your friends than with your professor, unless, of course, your professor understands the art of conversation. Indeed, one can generalize and define a community as a space within which many rules of competition and hierarchy are lifted, where the collective prevails over one's interest. Of course, there will be tension with the outside, but that's another discussion. This idea of competition being lifted within a group or a tribe was, once again, present in the notion of a group as studied by Eleanor Ostrom. Nonlinearity of progress. Now let us generalize to progress in general. Do you want society to get wealthy, or is there something else you prefer? Avoidance of poverty. Are your choices yours or those of salespeople? Let's return to the restaurant experience and discuss constructed preferences as compared to natural ones. If I had a choice between paying $200 for a pizza or $6.95 for the French complicated experience, I would readily pay $200 for the pizza, plus $9.95 for a bottle of Malbec wine. Actually, I would pay to not have the Michelin experience. This reasoning shows that sophistication can, at some level, cause degradation, what economists call negative utility. This